Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. Coming up in the show, art and science mingle as we discover the differences between the brain of a leading British artist with his friend and our guest, neuroscientist Mark Lithgow. Staying on a similar theme,
I actually danced proof of the irrationality of the square root of three, which must be a first in the history of dance and mathematics.
Yes, that was Marcus de Saitoy mashing up some maths and dance there. Later he'll be telling us about taking up the prestigious Simonyi Professorship for the Public Understanding of Science, a post recently vacated by none other than Richard Dawkins. And how many steps on the career ladder does it take to get from a kitchen assistant at Burger King to astronaut? Three? Four? Well, anyway, this man has done it.
When you finally do touch down on the ground, they don't usually like to use the word impact, but frankly, it's an impact. You know, you're hitting what feels like about 30 miles an hour in a 6-ton vehicle into the very solid earth, and so it is like a very violent car crash.
No stranger to Science Weekly computer games tycoon Richard Garriott tells us about experiments he carried out on his recent trip into space. Plus, we'll be analysing the science of Jonathan Ross and Russell Brand. Actually, we won't. In fact, this is a Manuel Gate free zone. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. First up, hello to Ian Sample, my sole Guardian companion in today's pod. Hello, Ian.
Hello there.
According to producer Andy, Nell still isn't clean enough to turn up, or it could be that she's just not in the office today. In an attempt to make up for her, though, is our special guest this week. Mark Lithgow is a neuroscientist. He's director at the Centre for Advanced Biomedical Imaging at University College London. Mark, welcome to the pod.
Ah, good to see you.
Mark's day job, as his job suggests, is imaging brains. But in a few weeks, he'll share a platform with British artist Richard Wentworth. There, they'll discuss what differences there are in the way their different brains see the world. What is it that you've been looking at in terms of improvisation and creativity? Because this is an area you've just recently started to look at.
So from my own perspective, I have an interest in creativity. And there was a guy that wrote to me, it must be 5-6 years ago, had had a stroke. And then after the stroke, had spontaneously started to create lots of artwork. He'd somehow released this inner creativity. And then it was about, must have been 6 months ago now, when a musician came to see me and he said, have you seen this paper? It's on jazz musicians. It's about improvisation. Can you interpret these findings for me? So I looked at the brain scans and you could see that the jazz musicians had turned off or deactivated part of their brain to allow those improvisational creative juices come through. But again, it's back to Richard Wentworth. It wasn't until I went to look at Richard's photographs that I was able to connect the improvisational study with our creativity study.
Just take us through some of Richard's photos, actually. You've got them in a presentation that you're going to give at the Wellcome Trust soon. But what kinds of things are we talking about? And why are they interesting to actually image people sort of looking at these things?
Okay, Richard looks at the world completely differently. I mean, that's what's fascinating about him. He's got this series called Making Do and Getting By, and that's what his photographs are about. And I'll give you a scenario. You're in the basement of your building. There's an alarm ringing somewhere. You're trying to work. You're trying to focus on something you're writing. But this alarm is driving you mad. So you go down to the basement of your building and you find this ruddy alarm that's been going off all day. And you've got to stop the alarm. And in your pocket, you've got a little fudge bar. And he's got this photograph of this lovely fudge bar that's been inserted between the hammer and the actual bell itself to stop it ringing. He captured that beautiful moment of intuitive improvisation, that moment of invention. And he calls it making do and getting by, as though it's sort of a bit of a shortcut. But it's more than that. It's that moment of discovery. And you look at the photograph and you go, oh yeah, that's so clever. And that's what's so special about Richard, is he allows us to look back at ourselves and he reminds us of those little things that we do perhaps every day that we miss that underpin that notion of invention or discovery.
And so how does that relate to your creativity research?
So the chap that wrote to us about 5-6 years ago, he'd had this stroke. It had affected one part of his brain. And as he said, something had spontaneously come to the surface, this artwork. Previously, he wasn't doing any artwork whatsoever. He was a builder. He was working on a building site. Had no interest in art. He had the stroke, comes out of a coma. He's on intensive care. Asks his wife, Jan, for a piece of paper. And he writes a sentence. And he writes another sentence. And the first sentence rhymed. with the second. He writes a paragraph of poetry. He profusely starts creating poetry. Comes out of hospital, asks for crayons, and he covers his whole house in these amazing murals. He comes down in the middle of the night, hacksaws up the dining room table, and starts creating sculptures. As he said, it's something had come to the surface that he hadn't done before, and it was expressed as this artistic creativity. And so it's that one part of the brain that had been affected, which seems to link up with the people that were doing the improvisational jazz. And for me, it's Richard, through his photographs, that's sort of highlighting this particular area, that moment of creative improvisation or invention.
What does the study of this sort of thing, the study of this creativity, imaging these brains, tell us about pathologies? Is there anything it tells us about brain damage generally or these neurodegenerative conditions? What does it tell us about the brain?
I think the first thing is understanding these processes. You can't do anything with them and to alter them, change them, make them better, unless you understand how they work. The other thing that you can't do, unless you understand the way they connect, you couldn't possibly try to enhance them. So a lot of the studies that have been coming out in the creativity world have said, OK, we know the frontal parts of the brain are involved with creativity. It seems to be that if you somehow deactivate them, that you become more creative. So therefore, can we try to deactivate the brain?
With drugs, perhaps.
With drugs, or mechanically. So there's this chap, Alan Schneider, and he's developed this wonderful crash helmet. You put it on, and underneath it, it's got these little coils. And he puts an electric current through a coil. And if you put an electric current through a coil, it turns into a magnet. It creates a magnetic field. This magnetic field goes through the skull, and it can knock out the brain cells. So then he knocks...
Is that safe?
My impression of this, and I've had this done on this one occasion, that it is safe, but it is the most unusual thing to have something that's effectively thinking for you. So he puts this device on, he knocks out the front of the brain, and then he gets people to draw a picture. He's got them to draw before they've had the brain knocked out, and then after. And you see these pictures of perhaps a three-legged dog or a three-legged cat, and then they draw their picture after having their frontal lobes knocked out, and there it is. It's a four-legged dog or a four-legged cat.
A better cat.
A better cat. I've never been completely convinced by the studies. However, that's the route that some neuroscientists are going.
So what you're saying is basically that the evolutionary development of the human brain, the thing that's made us have dominion over the world, as it were, which is the prefrontal cortex, this processing, thinking part of the brain, that's actually getting in the way of us all being really, really creative. If I could just chop my prefrontal cortex off, I would be a much, much more creative and probably more successful person than I am.
I don't think there's any... For you, lobotomy is the only way forward. For the rest of us, however, I might add a slight note of caution. There's no free lunches with the brain. I mean, it is this incredible balance. You know, you've got all these excitatory, you know, impulses. You've got this inhibitory impulses, and they're constantly competing for space, for our personality, our individuality, our imagination. So, of course, if you release one area, something can come to the surface. But, of course, you're always going to lose. There are no free lunches.
Well, let's just finish this bit with a quote that's from you. You say that improvisation is one of the most highly prized human attributes and that the one that's allowed us to develop into a modern man. Just unpack that for us a little bit. Evolutionarily speaking, what is this about?
I'll give you this scenario. You're in Borneo. You're on the banks of the Gahonga River. And you're an orangutan. You're starving hungry. And you're walking up and down the banks. And you can see the fishermen just upriver. They're fishing away in the centre. They're catching loads of fish. And, of course, you're an orangutan. You've got no fishing rod. You haven't done all that stuff. And he thinks, what can I do? And he walks down the river. And there's a net they've put across to try to trap the fish. There's a wonderful photograph of an orangutan from a primatologist hanging off a tree over the river. And he's got a large stick and he's using it as a spear. And as the primatologist put it, he's improvised using this spear to trap and catch the fish stuck in the net. And it is improvisation, that of the moment, invention and discovery that has really underpinned every moment of our development from Stone Age to Bronze Age, right the way through to modern man. We would not have had television without improvisation.
Mark, thank you so much. We're going to leave that there for now. And I think producer Andy will agree, without improvisation, this show would never get on the road. We're going to come back to you at the end of this programme as well. Mark's going to be speaking on the 9th of December as part of a series of discussions between artists and scientists at Bristol University. The series is called The Creative Brain. And other speakers include novelist Antonia Byatt, Nobel Prize winner Paul Nurse, and filmmaker David Putnam. You can find a link to that on our blog, guardian.co.uk/Science Weekly.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jar.
This week, Oxford University announced that mathematician Marcus de Sautoy will take up its Simonyi Chair for the Public Understanding of Science. It's a post that was held by Richard Dawkins for more than 10 years. He used it as a platform to publish several books on evolution and re-energise the debate on the existence of God. Now, Marcus is no stranger to this pod and is currently presenting a four-part series on the history of maths on BBC Four. Guardian Science correspondent James Randerson and I spoke to him about his new job and started by asking if he was nervous about the challenge of stepping into Richard Dawkins' ample scientific shoes.
No, not really, because I'm going to do my own thing. I think it's a really different departure for this professorship. It's a very different sort of science. I'm really looking forward to pushing mathematics and how mathematics actually feeds into all the other sciences. And I think it's a great choice of subject, actually, for the public understanding of science, because mathematics is somehow the language of all the sciences. So,
have you had a chat with Richard yet, Richard Dawkins yet? Just, you know, has he given you any advice? Has he given you his office?
No, I haven't actually. So, but you know, I do my own thing. So, I'm going to really define this as a, you know,
Richard Dawkins. He made a lot of enemies as well, especially in the last decade or so, when he started talking about religion a lot, and he was quite sort of political about all of this stuff. Are you going to focus on religion too? Or are you going to focus on that sort of cultural divide type stuff? Or are you just thinking, look, there's so much more other stuff interesting that I can tell you, I'm not going to get bothered in any arguments. But I mean,
no, I am bracing myself, of course, for everyone asking me whether I believe in God or not. Or my
views. Do you believe in God?
No, I'm an atheist. And I think, but for me, actually, the important thing is the wonder of science. And I think you put your finger on it exactly. There's so much exciting things to talk about science. I mean, I understand Richard's point. There are great fears about the power of the intelligent design movement in America. But my focus is really on trying to excite people about science, why I do it, why a lot of people do it, how it impacts on your life. It's very important to our whole society. Society is knocking up again and again against issues of science, and it's important that they have a grasp of what's going on to be able to make decisions. So my focus is going to be very much on the science and less on religion.
This professorship, actually, the Charles Simonyi professorship that Richard Dawkins held for so long, is the most famous, I think, and probably the most prominent of the science and society type professorships, where you have a scientist doing something specific in the communication field. I mean, Robert Winston has just been made a Science and Society Professor at Imperial College London. So there's more of these cropping up. I mean, Jim Al-Khalili is famous at Surrey doing exactly the same thing. Why do you think this stuff's becoming more and more popular? Why are more professors doing this?
Well, I think it's science is actually about two things: discovery and communication. And we're all communicating on whatever level, when we're giving a seminar, going to conferences. And so I think we're all used to communicating our ideas to other people. This is just on a broader scale. And I think it's very important that we have these ambassadorial roles, partly because who does science? It's those that get excited about science when they're a kid by somebody communicating the excitement of it. So that our next generation of scientists depends on people sort of broadening out and not just talking to those in the ivory towers. So I mean, I think it's really important. Also, there are very important issues for society about science. And it's important, I think, post the Jenkins report, which said that scientists need to do more to actually engage with society, that we have people who are prepared to download the science and dialogue with the public about it.
Now, I remember you doing a dance to some mathematical formula or something.
Actually danced a proof of the irrationality of the square root of 3, which must be a first in the history of dance and mathematics.
And someone holding two professorships at Oxford as well. Marcus, thank you very much. Mark, you're a friend of Marcus's. What do you make of his elevation to this status?
Brave man, brave man.
Why brave?
Well, anyone that would, you know, want to sleep in a in a bed that's been slept in by Richard Dawkins for the last 30 years has got to be pretty brave by my accounts.
Well, he did say, though, that he was going to try and steer his own path. He doesn't want to really go into the religion stuff. He's an atheist, but he doesn't want to really go into all that stuff. He wants to make maths the centre of attention.
Yeah, I think he's right to do that. You know, we've had someone ranting on for, you know, the last 30 years about one particular topic. And I think it's right. We do need a shift and a change. I think he's brave because this is an inextricably difficult topic. Richard Dawkins has always been able to hang his side of things on neuroscience, which is an inevitably quite a sexy topic. Maths is difficult, although it underpins every moment of our waking life. Maths is important. I think he's got a job on his hands, and I'd take my hat off to him.
I think you should scan his brain to see how creative he is. Now, for a quick look at some of the other stories this week, we've got producer Andy and Ian with the News Jam.
News Jam. Doctors have drawn up plans to screen older men for the male menopause. It's amid concerns that as many as one in five of the over 65s may be affected. The so-called andropause has also been linked to diabetes and obesity. Unlike the menopause in women, not all men experience the andropause, and scientists say only those showing clear symptoms should be offered testosterone injections.
The Royal Society has announced plans to study which planetary-scale geoengineering techniques might play a practical role in stemming the worst impacts of climate change. Geoengineering includes everything from placing mirrors in space that reflect sunlight to the Earth, to seeding the oceans with iron to encourage the growth of algae that can soak up atmospheric carbon dioxide. The motivation for the study is being questioned by Greenpeace, which says the scientific community is becoming so scared of our collective inability to tackle climate emissions that such outlandish schemes are being considered.
The world is heading for an ecological credit crunch far worse than the current financial crisis because humans are overusing the natural resources of the planet. The Living Planet report has calculated that humans are using 30% more resources than the Earth can replenish each year. As a result, we are running up an ecological debt of up to $4.5 trillion every year, double the estimated losses made by the world's financial institutions as a result of the credit crisis. David Norman is from the environmental group WWF.
We're working towards a situation where we would need something like a couple of planets, two planet Earths, for the whole global population to consume on the same trajectory, if you like. I mean, there's already been, over the last 35 years, something like a 30% decline in our wildlife index. So we look at some 1,700 different species around the world. We look at the populations of all those species. And that gives us an overall picture of something like a third in reduction in the populations of those species. And that's varies quite dramatically. So if you look at the temperate areas like Western Europe, it's fairly stable because we changed most of our land to agricultural land before 1970. But the really fast declines are in the tropics, and it's almost impossible to imagine continuing on these rates of decline over the next 25 years. They've halved in the tropics, the wildlife index, over the last 35 years. We can't go on cutting at that rate.
And finally, he's been dead for 53 years, but Einstein's estate still brings in a whopping $18 million a year. The great scientist comes in fourth in the annual ranking compiled by the US finance publication Forbes. The latest version of the list puts only Elvis Presley, the Peanuts cartoonist Charles M. Schulz, and the actor Heath Ledger above him.
Ian and producer Andy, thank you very much for those. Ian, take us through the andropause or male menopause story. I mean, how long have people known that this is kind of an issue?
It's been quite controversial for decades, I'd say. I mean, people have wondered if this thing exists. I think half of the problem almost is how we in the media talk about this thing inevitably as the male menopause. It's nothing like the menopause. I mean, all women will go through the menopause, and the consequences of that can be pretty stark. But with this male version, the andropause, I mean, all this is in some men. Maybe we're looking at one in five of the over 65s suffer a significant crash in testosterone, and that can cause a whole bunch of problems. And what these doctors are really saying this week is that GPs should be aware of this because there can be some problems that you can just put down to old age. One of them can be sort of fatigue and disinterest in sex and things like this. You start throwing drugs at people with that sort of, thinking that they just need pepping up a little bit. And they may have low testosterone. And those drugs might not work. So it's just useful stuff to know.
So what are they saying? You don't want to medicalize something that doesn't necessarily need intervention?
It's more about teasing out that there may be a condition underlying, I don't think massively serious one, because this does seem to be pretty treatable by giving people testosterone injections. There don't seem to be any particular problems in doing that, as long as obviously you're pretty careful with your dose. I think it's more about helping people who are really not responding to medication, who aren't getting help otherwise.
You can comment on all those stories, of course, at guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly.
Now, you're probably wondering by now, how many more dedicated and charismatic individuals could you possibly need to further the public's appreciation for science? Well, perhaps one more, we think. This time it's Richard Garriott, the self-made computer game tycoon with a very everyday wish to follow in his father's footsteps. However, in Richard's case, his father's footsteps lead all the way to outer space as part of the last Apollo mission to Skylab. Well, mission accomplished. Richard returned to Earth last week after a trip to the International Space Station. Our man Ian Sample went to meet him. Ian, what was he doing when you saw him?
He was wandering around in his spacesuit, actually. he's been back a week. When I first met him, he was wearing his spacesuit. And I asked at the reception of the hotel I was meeting him whether they'd seen anyone walking around in one. And then I got a call saying he was a little bit late. But he's been back a week. He's looking incredibly well. And he's clearly a man changed by being in space.
Sitting on a tiny little capsule on the top of a giant stack of liquid oxygen and kerosene for fuel is pretty exciting, just to walk up the stairs, much less light it up. Although it's very smooth and very elegant, I often describe it as kind of a ballet, a very powerful but comfortable and confident ballet. The return trip on Soyuz is a little more raucous. You come in as a fireball through the ionosphere, and you can see that very clearly out the windows as the heat shields are ablating around you. When the parachutes open, you get tossed about a fair bit, and bits and pieces that aren't held down too well scatter about the cabin. And when you finally do touch down on the ground, they don't usually like to use the word impact, but frankly, it's an impact. You're hitting what feels like about 30 miles an hour in a 6-ton vehicle into the very solid earth, and so it is like a very violent car crash. But you're in a very well-developed seat that is specifically molded to your body and has this crushable shock absorber in it, so you actually are not injured or bruised in any way. But the violence around you in the spacecraft is quite notable.
But just take us back to that, the moment in the morning. Can you give people an impression of what the capsule's like on the inside? Is this very cramped? How many of you are in there? And then what can you see as when they sort of light the candle, if you like?
Well, the space capsule is very, very close quarters. Not only are you sitting shoulder to shoulder, but if you're in the center seat, you could easily touch the left and right walls. And the control panel is within reach in front of you. And your feet are touching the outer surface, of one side, and your head is really against the parachute compartments, but otherwise against the other outer wall. For example, if you had to change seats with each other, there's not really enough space to switch seats as a case study. In fact, you're so cramped in there. One thing that does go through at least my mind is that if there was some emergency that required you to get out of there quickly, you're not getting out of there quickly. And so you just hope you don't encounter that particular kind of an emergency. When you climb up to board the Soyuz, that day, I'd been in it a couple of times before, but this was the first time it was fully fueled. And the liquid oxygen is loaded very, very cold in order to keep it in that liquid state. And so the entire spacecraft is covered with white frost. And it's so cold that any air that's coming anywhere near it not only condenses more of this frost, but then descends down the sides of the vehicle in a kind of a condensation smoke. So there's the whole vehicle is smoking with this downward flow of smoke down into the pit below it. And once you get on board, during the first phases of launch, there's a fairing around the space capsule, so you can't actually see out any windows. But while you're sitting there, there's a 40-minute lull before they light it up. And you can actually sit there as you're sitting there, you can feel the wind causing it to sway just a little bit. Since there's no commands during that 40 minutes, Mission Control actually plays what I would describe as elevator music, which I thought was quite funny, because here we are in our elevator to the sky and we're listening to elevator music. And we'd all done this, we'd rehearsed this so many times, we all just closed our eyes and, you really could relax very comfortably and, basically fall asleep there, just minutes before launch. But then, once the 5-minute bell strikes, you get very busy. 5 seconds before launch, you feel the whole thing. You begin to feel pumps and valves click and clack, open and shut, and the engines start up, and you feel the thrust. And then exactly on the second on time, you lift up into the sky.
That was Richard Garriott talking to Ian Sample there. You can hear the full interview that Ian did with him later on this week at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And remember, there's also about another half an hour before he went up into space in that archive somewhere. So full hour of Richard Garriott, if that's what you're into.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Let's take a quick look now at what you've been saying on the blogs. Producer Andy's been trawling through them. Take it away, Producer Andy.
Parky DR wonders about the relevance of the atheist ads in a science podcast from last week. I didn't really see the point of the bit about atheist ads. It isn't science's job to convert people to atheism. It's a pointless discussion. It all comes down to the difference between faith, belief with no need of evidence, and science. The advert shows the problem by using the word probably. It's hard to prove a negative. Just stick to science and only mention religion when it's relevant, e.g. debunking pseudoscience like intelligent design. And one from Oakley. He quite likes the idea of the challenge of designing a 1,000-mile-an-hour car. But why do we have to have it tied to making kids do physics, he asks. Is there any evidence at all that this sort of thing makes kids more interested in science projects or doing science at school? Is it not just that the kids who would do science anyway find this particularly interesting? If I'm being unfair, let's see some evidence for it. If not, let's just go at 1,000 miles an hour for the sake of engineering achievement, because we can.
Plenty more posts on those subjects. Have a look for yourself. Before we wrap up this bit, actually, this point that Parky DR makes about atheism not being something that we should be talking about on the science podcast. I don't know. I disagree with that. I think that the point of the campaign and the reason why I'm interested in it, the reason I think our listeners will be interested in it, is about how you think about the world. It's not about whether you believe in God or not, really. It's about evidence. It's about thinking, what's your thought process when you come to a conclusion about something? And the atheist campaign, I think, is actually quite a scientific thing. When they say there's probably no God, now go off and enjoy your life, that first sentence is a very scientific thing to say. There's probably no God. You can't ever prove there is no God, of course, because as Parky DR says, you don't prove a negative, but science is never about proving negatives. I don't know if you guys have anything to say about that.
Science certainly doesn't work in isolation, and I think that's the nice thing about it, is that it impacts on culture at every moment. I think also because I was brought up an incredibly strong Catholic, and I was sent, so I expressed some vague interest in wanting to be a priest, and my mother sent me straight off to this special school to train to be a priest, and of course I renounced it when I finally found science the new religion. But I do have those little moments when someone's talking about, the Big Bang, multiple universes, and I think that is really improbable. Probably just about as improbable as there is having one, single omnipotent being. So in terms of improbabilities, the jury's probably still out for me.
You're almost a trained priest. You're full of stories, aren't you?
I didn't tell you the one about the dog trainer.
We'll leave that there. Your thoughts on the show are always welcome. Either join our Facebook group and post a comment on the wall, or leave us a little text present on the blog now at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Back to you, Mark. We've talked a lot in the first bit about creativity and how it manifests itself in the brain, which bits are lighting up, which bits aren't. Traditionally, creativity is seen as something that artists do, that people who are outside science do. Now, I've always argued, and I'm sure I'm not the first, that science itself takes a huge amount of creativity, stepping into the unknown. People like Marcus, in maths especially, you're talking about really abstract things that they're doing. Is there any? Do you see any difference between creativity in artists and scientists?
Oh, this drives me mad. This really gets my goat. The amount of times you've seen, whether it's articles, books, even studies, there's even been studies on creativity where they will have musicians, artists, playwrights, no scientists in the study. It's as though scientists can't be creative.
It's all technical, isn't it? Numbers?
Yeah, there's nothing in that. There's nothing inspiring. There's nothing that can contribute. My own feeling is that it's a identical process. When you have a new thought, when you create something for the first time, whether it's in an artistic domain or a scientific domain, it requires the same cognitive processes. So I have no doubt that cognitively they're exactly the same. Of course, you need those underlying skills. The skills from a musician to a scientist are going to be completely different. But what brings it all together, that's where our common ground is. And that's why you can investigate both scientists and artists at the same time.
So it's what you were saying before. You break down the walls, allow the improvisation, the creativity to come in, and then you can just decide where to focus it, whether it's playing an instrument to amazing standards or whether it's doing maths or physics or whatever. Ian, you got a question?
I'm just a bit fascinated by when you talk about how a lot of creativity comes from essentially switching off these large parts of the brain. Does that not have any sort of other impact on us? I mean, presumably, you know, the parts of the brain are all doing multiple tasks at once, aren't they?
Yeah, the switching off. I mean, the reason why we have developed the ability to attend to stuff is because we need to focus on specific tasks. Probably, you know, 95% of our day, most of the time we're at work, you just need to get on with one thing, you know, and be able to do that one thing well. It's only those single moments of inspiration that you need to feed into it, into that focus stuff, that then you work through the idea to see if it works or if it's a hypothesis, that you can work through that and test it. So I think the majority of our mind, our brain, is in this space where we can hone ourselves down to particular things. And I think that's why it's quite hard to get into the creative space, because we're just not used to it. And I think we have to work quite hard to find that.
Mark, take us a step back a little bit. As we said at the beginning, you work as a neuroscientist. Neuroscience is one of the sexy subjects of the 21st century. I mean, understanding the brain is, we're getting to a stage where we can image, we can look at what people are thinking, well, not almost what people are thinking, which bits of the brain light up for various other things.
Sure.
There are lots of different imaging mechanisms. Where are we going with all of this stuff? And what will we be able to do with this science, in the next 20, 30 years?
Mind control and brain transplant.
And
you're first in the queue. Come
after my
to
lobotomy.
See me next week.
After my lobotomy.
If I'm not looking too far into the future, one of the things that we've been very good at is to look at anatomy with the brain scanners and function to some degree, the bits of the brain that light up. The one thing that we can't do very well is to look at the molecular and cellular processes. Let's say which brain cells actually light up, which are the chemicals that are involved with that. So part of the research that's going on globally now is to be able to investigate or look at individual cells, which is why we started to put the iron oxide particles into these cells to see if we could see where they were. The extension of that is, if you're developing a therapy and you inject a stem cell into someone and they've had a heart attack or a stroke, how do you get that stem cell to go to the brain or to the heart or the eye and regenerate that particular organ? So it was back to the Nanotechnology Centre, and they gave us a different bucket load of nanoparticles, and they said these ones become magnetic.
Are they just like when you're in Bond or something? They're the Q division.
Q, you go down to the basement.
You need a solution.
Nanotech.
sorry. Carry on.
So we got these magnetic particles, and we designed these magnets that you could put outside the body, and you can inject the stem cells in one place and then direct them to the parts of the body that you want them to go to with these external magnets. Now, that's putting a jacket on someone or something like that. Now, the extension of that is, an MRI scanner is just a big magnet. instead of just using the magnets for imaging, so you would use the magnet, you go into the brain scanner, you see somewhere someone's had a stroke, the areas of damage will perhaps light up. You inject your stem cells. Can you then use the magnetic field of the scanner to literally take each particle or each chemical or each cell and direct it into part of the brain or the heart that you want to go? So these imaging devices will also become therapeutic devices, which at the end of the therapy, then you'll be able to image again and see if your patient's got better.
Well, Mark, we're going to leave all that stuff there. Thank you so much. When you're ready to do the brain transplant, you can come back in. We'll do
first,
it live.
Thank you.
Except that I think I want Ian to go through it first, just to make sure it works. And Dan, he needs a new brain. Well, we're at the end there. Remember, Mark is going to be speaking with artist Richard Wentworth on the 9th of December as part of a series of discussions between artists and scientists at Bristol University. My thanks to him and to Guardian Science correspondent Ian Sample for their sparkling words of wisdom on this week's show. Carefully hacking the programme together this week was the dream team of Andy Duckworth and Jason Phipps. They're off to check their producer guidelines. I think that involves inserting a few swear words, leaving some abusive voicemails for ageing actors, and then running off to join a burlesque group. I'm Alok Jha. See you next time. Anyone got a number for Michael Crawford?